Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Welcome back to our second housing session for the day. For those who weren't here this morning, I'm Pauline Williams. I'm an advocate and I work at AMIDA, which is Action for More Independence and Dignity in Accommodation. This panel will focus more on the supported accommodation sector. For disability advocates, I know this makes up a large part of the work we do, as mainstream housing advocacy information services don't generally provide advocacy to people living in supported accommodation. If you do go into onto the DHH housing website, which is quite useful, you'll find that they actually do list all the different tenure types on that website, including supported accommodation. And I'd encourage you to check it out, as it is quite a useful resource. It's just housing.vic.gov.au, so it's pretty easy. And they have a housing finder there, and if you plug in some details and just make them up, you'll see that it throws up a whole lot of different services and suggestions. So it's quite a useful resource. Just by way of introduction, we know that there are thousands of people with disabilities currently on the waiting list for supported accommodation or a support package or both. And the Disability Support Register is the list, I guess, for people who've been found eligible for those supports. We'll hear a bit more about that from our panel today. I'm not sure what the latest figure is for those waiting for supported accommodation. Might be a question on notice for you guys. You might not know either, but I know it's thousands. Yes. But whatever that figure is, it's only those who've applied and been found eligible to be on the list and in immediate need, therefore. National Disability Services is the peak provider for not-for-profit disability services in Australia, and they actually did some estimates before the last state election of how many people with a disability are in need of housing, and it was 20 to 30,000. That's in Victoria alone. And they're saying that because they know that there's a huge untapped need where people who haven't had support packages and will get them with the NDIS will need somewhere to live. At the April COAG, or Coalition of Australian Governments Disability Reform Council, housing was on the agenda and was reported on. And I don't know if people have read it or seen it and know what the latest is, but the ministers noted that the total budget for the full scheme NDIS does include capital costs for some specialist accommodation. Some of these funds, however, will need to be used to support existing specialist accommodation, the group homes that we already have, and in Victoria there are about 1,000. So they didn't give the proportions for how much of that funding will be for existing and how much will be for new. The balance, though, will be used to support people with disability requiring integrated housing and support, and also to be used to help people access housing in the private market and to enable the market to generate innovative specialist disability housing, whatever that means. The council has asked officials to work with the NDIA to support the development and testing of innovative accommodation pilots in the trial sites of the NDIS that will help expand the supply of appropriate and sustainable integrated housing and support models, which may include existing models, contemporary and or innovative supports. Those are the words of the actual communique. It also went on to say initially this will focus in the trial sites where there's adequate funds. And again, they didn't say, it wasn't clear which trial sites that might be. Those trials will start to provide us with evidence about how different models contribute to outcomes for participants, but this will take time. I think it should be noted that advocates have lots of experience of what goes on in different models of supported accommodation, so I'm hoping that that will be taken into account too. It's very important, the communique said, that we take a measured approach to investment to ensure that the scheme is sustainable and can meet the needs of participants into the future. Increasing the supply of specialist housing will be incremental, it said, with a small number of initial pilots helping to define a path forward. The NDIS efforts in relation to specialist disability housing, they noted, will be in addition to ongoing mainstream support from the states and territories. So there's still a bit of jockeying going on, and even some of those words I think are designed to get responses from different state governments, and that we don't get a lot of detail. However, we do know that in Victoria this year there was a budget provision made for an additional 830 individual support packages over the next 4 years. Not for bricks and mortar housing though, it's for support provision. And there was no allocation for additional mainstream housing through public housing or community housing. There was only allocation for maintenance of the existing stock. So the only group housing that I'm aware of that's being built in Victoria at the moment is there are 20 residents who will be moving out of Calanda, which is an institution in Colac, and money was made available before the election for those people to move into group housing. And the Oakley Centre has also been provided funding to close, so the funding for the closure of that will supply group housing, not on site, they're selling the site. So that's the only group housing that I know of, or specialist supported accommodation that's being built. And it's already spoken for those people. So demand for supported accommodation is high. However, alarmingly, supported accommodation is consistently the area that attracts the most complaints to the Disability Services Commissioner. So, well, on the one hand, it's needed greatly. It's also not necessarily without problems. And none of us are unaware of the issues of violence and abuse that have been reported in these services, and of which there have been a number of inquiries this year. But often it's the less dramatic daily restrictions on people's lives and lack of choice that undermine the quality of life of residents. Community visitors report year after year that services are not good and not as good as they need to be. So even the Ombudsman's report recently on investigating and reporting abuse found it's a very complicated complaint system and that there's a litany of non-compliance they found. So as advocates, we need to understand how to support people, firstly to get into supported accommodation, but also how to resolve issues once they do get in that may arise. And I often think the real problems start for people when they get the service they were waiting for. Now, our panel members today work in particular areas of that system, not the whole area. So we can't expect them to tell us everything about the picture, but hopefully we'll hear a bit more about that picture. For myself as an advocate, I have lots of questions and I hope you'll think of some questions. We'll allow time for that. But to start, let's welcome our first panel members. Angela Kopke is the Senior Vacancy Coordinator with DHHS Disability Support Register and Vacancy Management Client Support Service. And she's joined by her colleague, Andrew McCarty, who is a Vacancy Coordinator in the DHH Disability Support Register and Vacancy Management Client Support Services team. They're in the Western Division. So welcome, Angela and Andrew.
Hi, everybody.
Hi. Thank you for the introduction and the explanation for who we are and what we do.
Yeah.
I'm going to speak a little bit about the Disability Support Register, outlining how you get on that list, and then once I've explained that, Angela will explain a little bit more about the vacancy management side of things. So in order to get ongoing funding, whether that's for community access or housing, you need to submit a Disability Support Register, which outlines various things, including other options that have been canvassed. Once that does get registered, it goes onto a list. With that, then when new packages become available, that list is explored to see who would fit that. And then an offer of a package would be made available. We do have some information here outlining what happens after the application is registered. It does get reviewed, so circumstances can change, and it's reviewed regularly, so sometimes people get contacted to update it because circumstances will be changed and then they may
So things that you would look at in a review would be maybe change of location. So it might be somebody previously, when the DSR was submitted, was living at home with their family and the situation has changed and they've moved into another location, or maybe they're living in transitional accommodation or temporary accommodation. So they're things that we like to update, especially in relation to applications for shared supported accommodation, because that could mean a change in priority for that person, but it also would look at changes in their abilities. It might be that somebody has a degenerative disorder and we need to be aware of how that's affecting them now, so that we can look at accommodation that meets their specific needs at this time. We've got people have put in DSRs back years and years ago, and if you look at that, the ones that they were put in maybe 5 years ago, somebody's abilities or somebody's support needs have dramatically changed from 5 years ago. And if we're basing our decision from 5 years ago, we might not be looking at what's going to meet their needs for now. So we want to make sure it's for now that we're looking at for them.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
When they are registered, there's a couple of ways that a vacancy can become available. Someone can move out, so someone may move into, move back home with their parents, someone may pass on, someone may move into residential aged care. And then once the process, the vacancy is declared to the panel then refer back to the DSR, which has a list of everyone in the particular division. And that outlines what their specific requirements may be. And then we've got some fairly tight timeframes that Angela will again help me out and talk a little bit about. Yeah.
So once a vacancy is declared, it's usually declared within a 5-day period, and then we bring together and review the people that are on the DSR. So shared supported accommodation houses have different models. They're focused towards different support needs, different people. So there are models for people in My Future, My Choice, so people that have Huntington's disease or MS, or there's the more supported models of people with intellectual disabilities that may be non-verbal, non-ambulant, that require more intensive support needs. So different houses provide different levels of support. So we would review the DSR, we'd scope the DSR to see who would match that support, that house that's become available, and then bring together a short list. And we also focus it around the location of the house. So being in West Division, we do cover from Footscray all the way to the South Australia-Victoria border. And so it is quite a large division. And so we wouldn't want to put somebody up that's applying only for Footscray and go, well, would you like a house in Portland? They're not necessarily going to want to move to Portland, but that's how we base our criteria on. We look at what that person is requesting and where that is. We then bring together a shortlist and we bring together a panel. That panel, depending on whether it's a CSO house or a DAS house, or a Disability Accommodation Service house, is made up. We try to get together a panel of five, so that's a DHS representative, two CSO representatives, a carer of a person with a disability, and a person with a disability to represent the wider community and to make a transparent and unbiased decision. We, as the facilitators, do not vote on who gets allocated. We just facilitate the process. So once a panel is brought together and the shortlist is presented, each resident or each person that's being put up, they have a representative, so that might be a case manager, day program, respite, or it might be more than one person that presents them. And that is how the decision is made. It's not based solely on the DSR information that was submitted. It's based on information that's brought together by somebody that knows them. From that, we can kind of come up with three outcomes. It could be that a person is offered the placement, they believe that they're a match to the house and that placement's offered. You can then offer the placement and come up with a second. So sometimes panels look at the people that are presented and it might be that more than one person matches, but one person might come over the line first because of priority of need. So then you can offer for a secondary offer to be made if the first person declines, or you may come out of the panel and no one's offered the placement. So then we go back and review the DSR from there.
Yeah. So Once the match has been determined, there's a process of transitioning from them from their current housing arrangements to the shared supported accommodation. That is a case-by-case basis. Sometimes it can take a number of months, sometimes it can take a couple of weeks. With that, normally the client meets the, or the applicant meets the other residents. They might go over there for a couple of hours, get a bit of orientation, then go back home, or then they might have dinner there, get to know them. Sometimes they might just slot in straight away. Once they are happy and comfortable to move in, then they can do so. They can also decline at any stage of this process. Once the residents are in there, if they have any concerns about what's going on, the houses are generally staffed during the evenings. Most houses are not staffed between about 9 and 3 o'clock because that's generally when people are out in the community. But there are some variations with that according to the individuals. So if there are any concerns or issues that the resident may feel they need to address, they can speak to their staff. If they're not happy with that, they can escalate it through the specific processes of the organisation that runs that place, or by calling the Disability Commissioner or any of these that were actually listed here.
And so I know one question that was raised prior to this was if a person has moved into accommodation or they're in accommodation and they're not, they feel as though it either isn't meeting their needs or they'd like to move to something different, then the process starts again. So you can either apply for a reconfiguration within the current organisation that you're in, or then you submit a DSR, a new DSR, and you go through the process again. But it doesn't mean that you lose your placement at the current house that you're in. It's just that they will scope and look at other placements and consider you with everybody else. And I know a big question that comes up, especially when older people are moving in from home to shared supported accommodation that we get from families, is, well, what does that mean? Do I get to see them? Do I get to spend time with them? And just because somebody's in shared supported accommodation doesn't mean that they don't get to go and spend time with their family, or they don't get to go even stay with their family. I know a lot of older carers get a bit worried about that, that they're kind of placing their child and they're never going to have them home. And that's not the case at all. They can have as much involvement as their life in their life as possible. And just because somebody's in shared supported accommodation doesn't mean that ultimately, if their goal is to live independently, that they don't work towards that within the house as well. The main goal of the staff and what they work towards is goal focused, or that's what they were working towards, goal focused and person centred planning for the guys and the residents in the houses. So if somebody's ultimate goal is to move independently, then that's something that will be supported within that house. Yep.
I think we might Hello. Well, am I on? That's better, sorry. If it's okay, we might just take some questions now, because we've got about 10 minutes before we need to move on. So it's an opportunity, if you've got questions about the vacancy management process, now's your chance. Now, we do have a roving mic somewhere in the room. And I think it's just on the way. So I've got one over here, Heather, and Paula? Penny, sorry. I'm Pauline. I knew it was P. Okay. Can I go? I think the mic's coming now.
Hi, I'm Sophie, Disability Advocate, Migrant Resource Centre and Disability Justice Advocacy. What you were just mentioning at the end there about supporting people who want to live independently one day.
Mm-hmm.
So we've talked about how long the lists are of the people wanting to move into supported accommodation, but mm-hmm. there's also a long list of people wanting to move out,
mm-hmm.
and they can't, because they're stuck, because they can't get the ISP that they need to live independently.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose my question is, what's the department, like, two-part question, from your perspective, is the best process for people to take to be able to make that happen, and also what's the department doing to support that to happen? Like, exit ISPs ever going to be reintroduced, or what's going on to actually turn that into reality.
Yeah, and that's a hard one. I know that's a tricky one about moving, that needing an ISP to move into independent accommodation. The main process that we would say would be to go through the DSR and applying through that and highlighting what that person is wanting to use that for and highlighting that it is for independent accommodation. It will be, again, based on when targets become available, when resources become available, and whether that person and resource becomes available to be allocated to that specific person. I think it's important there is an intake number to call, and if somebody is getting more and more desperate or they're wanting to fasten the process, calling intake and reiterating their stance or this is what they're wanting to do and making sure that it's updated on a regular basis, that this is still something that they're exploring, that's a way to go about it. Fortunately, we all know that ISPs, there is a long time frame for that, and I don't know, Central, I'm sure, would be the better place to go to answer the bigger picture one around what DHHS in general looking at for people to move into accommodation, and I'm not sure where that's sitting within NDIA either at this stage, but the process would be DSR at the stage and then updating, constantly updating on information of how that person's going and what they're wanting to do.
Okay, we also had a question from Penny and Heather. So, thank you.
So this is a bit of a two-parter. I just wanted to rejoin from Sophie. I think you've registered the number of people looking for shared support at a com, because that's sort of all you can register that you want, even if you don't want that. So if you want accommodation, you have to register that you want shared support at a com, not that you're looking for housing on the DSR.
Do you want
Sorry, I don't understand the question.
When you fill out the DSR,
yes,
to tick the box for accommodation,
yes,
you're looking for shared supported accommodation.
Yes.
So therefore, that's what you're measuring, even though that's presumably not what the demand is for. You're not measuring, your statistics don't reflect the demand.
I think that could probably be a fair summation of it, yes.
So it'd be great to change that form around so that you could actually notice the sort of housing that people with disability would actually prefer, and that gets fed up.
Yep.
But that wasn't my question. My question is my question is about people having increasing support needs who are living in shared support at a com and then being transferred into residential aged care. Mm-hmm. And I'm just curious about the policy around that.
My understanding is we review, the DSR is supposed to outline what the scenarios are, what the specific individual is needing, as well as what they're already receiving. I think with that, divisionally there have been differences with younger people living in residential aged care, for instance, that can result in, is it an enhancement package? Yep, so.
So it's somebody already living in accommodation and they're moving them into aged care. Okay. My understanding, and don't quote me on policy because policy is not my greatest area, the ultimate goal would be for somebody to remain in shared supported accommodation if it's a viable option. So if additional supports can be added into the house, then that's what they would look at first. There are some instances, though, where it might be seen as a more viable option or a better supported option that people be in aged care. I don't know the policy on that, but that is my understanding.
So I guess the question then is it regarded by the department that you fund the house more, or that the individual with increasing support needs to access an ISP through that very long waiting list to get the extra support in the house that way? Because that's a very big difference.
Yeah, it is. It varies. In some instances, it is the house. It looks at the house, and especially if it's rostered staffing, because they would be funding the staffing within the house, not specifically, even though it would be specifically for that person, it'd be like a roster review of reviewing why does this person, or why do we need extra staffing, and why isn't the current number of rosters working for the residents that they currently have in the house.
So does the department have a contingency for the fact that the group of residents in aged shared supported accommodation are currently ageing, and are they committed to ageing in place for this group of residents if that's what they choose, the way that ageing in place applies to our community more generally for elder people? Or is there, I mean, I'm seeing a bit of a tendency to try and put young people in aged care out of shared supported accommodation.
My understanding is once you turn 65, you don't get moved from the shared supported accommodation. You don't lose your ISP. And if you are on the register, you don't cease to be on the register once you do turn 65. So I don't think there's any specific ageism related.
It's not ageism, it would be more a problem about how people with disability are viewed, because I'm seeing people well under 65 being moved from shared support accommodation to aged care. So
this is a very good discussion, but I'm going to have to move it on. Sorry. Heather had a question.
Is there any more houses being built to accommodate those on the waiting list who are living from, who are still living with their parents, say from 50 years old to up until they're 90, that's the parents, and especially those with high support needs, and the parents, if they can't get an accommodation, what do? Put them in respite, refuse to pick them up, so they become homeless and the department has to find somewhere for them. Have you any transitional houses like you used to have? I know because I've worked in the field and I've been a community visitor as well.
In West, like Pauline was saying, I know that Kalinda is the one that they're looking at. I know of, there's not very many new builds going on, and that's a fact, and I think everybody is aware of that.
You're still waiting for the NDIS, but that doesn't cater for housing for those with high support needs. Yeah.
On the DSR, one of the priority criteria, which if you have a look on the website, it gives you an idea of the priority criteria when you are registered. One of those is looking at people that are living with ageing carers. So people that are, it might be for the first time applying for supports. One of the priority criteria that we have now is if somebody is living with their parents and they are ageing. So it is something that is highlighted as being definitely being a need, and they are, so being on priority means that you might get looked at first. Doesn't necessarily mean that you'll get it first because the register isn't a waiting list, but it means that we will highlight and we can monitor how that's tracking as well. So how many people are applying for support, especially shared supported accommodation, who are living with aging carers still.
I think we've got time for one more question. Is there any other questions?
There's another question.
Yeah.
Have a limited two.
Hi, I'm a mother of a young girl with Down syndrome. She's 20. She hopes to move out of home, and so do I one day.
like any parent.
As well as her. Both ways. You mentioned that there are different types of supported accommodation types of houses.
Yeah.
How many different types are there? And how... this is so that she could fit in, so that I can be comfortable that she will fit in and, you know, make a successful transition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you would know how many clients you have. So I'm just wondering how many different categories of different types of housing would be needed and how many do you actually have? Mm-hmm.
Couldn't give you a number on exactly how many different models we have, but an example of different models would be, so there are some, like I was saying, some where it's staffed 24/7, nearly one-on-one support due to high personal care needs or even behaviours of concern. It then can drop down a little bit and be that there's staffing around, there might be one client that requires some additional staffing, additional support, but not everybody. Drop down again, and you've got that clients might need a little bit of prompting every now and then. They might need staff to be there in the house at all times if they need to seek them out, but not necessarily one-on-one kind of instance. And then drop down again, and then you've got some houses that aren't staffed at all times. So it might be staffing for a couple of hours in the morning and then in the afternoon, but there are times for the people to be independent within that unit and be there on their own. Houses usually, there's usually five is the average of people residing in SSAs, five or six. There are some houses that are two residents, some houses that are three. That's not as common, but there are houses out there that cater to the more independent clients or even residents that are wanting to transition. So they might be going from home to shared supported accommodation for the first time and needing some of that prompting and needing some of that reassurance that staffing is there. Jellybrand actually have a very good program where they have four houses that are next to each other, four units that are next to each other. Starts off from a house where the staff sleep there, but they're not there all the time, so the residents have the ability to leave and come and go as they please. Then step down to the next two units, which are a little bit more independent. Staff are in the first unit, so they have to actively seek them out, but the staff then come throughout the day, come in, and then you've got the front unit, which is a completely independent model, which staff are there if they need them, if they need to call them, but basically they're living independently. That's a great model, I think, but there's some of the type of models that are out there at the moment.
And is there any opportunity for parents like myself to co-invest or something similar to a private-public partnership, you know, that builds roads? Can we build houses? And who do I contact?
The only one that I'm aware of where there's you can stay there and your child is in their own area, so it's like a group home, but there's accommodation for the elderly parents, is the Winteringham one in Dandenong. And that's a terrific model. We think that's fantastic. It works very well. But that's the only one that I'm aware of in Victoria that's one that operates like that, where there's co-location.
Yeah.
Also, with the... There's a component of the DSR that you can actually say whether you would be willing to co-contribute to some housing. So, I mean, there's only a few of them around, but that is something that can be explored.
Terrific. Thank you.
No worries.
We're going to have to move on. So, sorry if you didn't get to ask your question, but let's thank Andrew and Angela very much for coming along. Our next panel member is Margaret Summers, and Margaret is the manager of SRS and Accommodation Support, which is locating within Ageing, Aged Care, Mental Health, Wellbeing, Social Capital and Ageing Team at DHHS. How do you fit that on your card? Would you please welcome Margaret Summers?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you very much for inviting me along today to talk to you about, I guess, another aspect of this continuum of supported accommodation. Can I just ask how many people here have actually been inside a supported residential service or know of people who are living there? Okay, so you would there'll be a fair bit of expertise already in the room. Just one moment, I'll get my props. So you would know that supported residential services are actually operated by private proprietary businesses and regulated by the government. 3 years ago, we actually pulled out the legislation and the regulation from the old Health Services Act and got our standalone legislation and regulations. And that has been quite a ride in terms of trying to look at what we can do in the space of regulation. So supported residential services provide accommodation and support for people who need support in everyday life. But the and people make choices about going to live in a supported residential service. Sometimes that choice might seem as though it's the last resort for people, or they're referred there by their through the mental health service provider or through the disability service provider, through an alcohol and other drugs rehab service provider. There's a whole range of people who require different supports, who have different types of disabilities or frailties. They're privately operated. They have to be registered with the state government. And so we're responsible, my area is responsible for registering the premises from which a proprietor wants to operate an SRS, and we're responsible for approving the proprietor as suitable to operate an SRS. So that's an important distinction about making sure the building is suitable for a fit for the purpose of being able to operate an SRS, so that the proprietor can comply with the regulations. I guess the point to make about supported residential services is that it is a minimum standard system. It's got minimum standards of personal support and accommodation standards that are set out in a group of 15 standards within the regulations and the requirements and the outcomes that we want proprietors to try and achieve for residents. The Department of Health and Human Services has the responsibility for administering this legislation, and currently there are 141 registered supported residential services across the state. Because they're privately run, they make the decision about the services that they will provide, the people that they accommodate, and the fees that they charge. Okay, so and the legislation doesn't cap fees, but it does set out quite prescriptively the services provided. One of the great things about having our standalone legislation is that there was a lot of consultation about this, and it's good to have Rosemary coming after, because the Office of the Public Advocate and other advocacy agencies made very strong submissions about the need to make sure that the human rights principles were bedded into this legislation. And that lifted up, I think, the level of what this legislation was about from where it had come from under the Health Services Act. Of course, our challenge now is making the proprietors and the residents aware of what their rights and responsibilities are, so that they can get the best of those human rights principles to improve their living in SRS. So we not only register them and try to make sure that the proprietors are suitable to operate, but we also regulate them, we monitor them. So we have authorised officers who conduct inspections. They conduct audit inspections, they take different parts of the legislation and they'll go and say, right, show us all of your resident, your record keeping systems, show us how your can meet emergency standards and so on, and how you are running your services to make sure that residents, you know, have got a quality lifestyle in the SRS. So there are different types of inspections that the authorised officers conduct. One is just the audit inspections to see that they're compliant. The other inspections are related to where there might be complaints from residents or external sources, so that they can respond to the complainant, they can identify issues and respond to them. Other inspections might be where an incident has occurred in an SRS and the response of the management of the SRS hasn't been adequate, and so the authorised officers might conduct an inspection to see what could have been done better and to support the proprietor to do the right thing and to make sure that residents' safety and well-being is being ensured. And not only that, but we do have, because you have congregate setting, you know, we do have resident-on-resident issues arising and they have to be managed. And then the other types of inspections that occur, under the same legislation, we have the community visitors who will also visit. They will make queries of residents to make sure that if the proprietor said, here's the services that we can provide for the fees that you're paying, and residents have the opportunity to talk to community visitors, and if community visitors aren't satisfied that the proprietor is actually doing the right thing, they can raise those issues of concern with the department to follow up and follow through and then respond to the community visitors. The new legislation also required that the proprietor themselves has a complaint system to be able to improve the capability of private proprietors. And I guess the thing is that there's quite a range of difference across the different proprietors. Some proprietors run, you know, very good facilities and have really good services in place to make sure that their residents are getting the services that they need, that they're connected to their communities and connected to their families, and they will support them to do it. Others we identify as needing extra training and supports to be able to understand what the philosophy is behind the legislation. Okay. Oh, right. Okay, then. So that's probably just a quick summary of it. Lots of other services go into SRS, RDNS, the mental health supports, disability case managers. We also have oral hygienists go into some of them. The Victorian Eye Service also does vision assessments for residents in some of them. And we would like those programs to be extended. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Do you have questions now?
I'm sorry. I might just have to stop you there, just so we can have a few questions before we move on to our final panellists. So are there any questions regarding the SRSs that Margaret might be able to assist with? Yes. Carol, Mike's coming.
Just with the SRSs and residents, probably just... I mean, how do we make them aware of regulations? It's they're often, you know, they're transiting in and out. They may not stay there very long, or they might go to another one or other forms of housing. But I'm not all that sure in our area that the residents are actually aware of the regulations in the ones that we've visited so far.
Okay, so there is information available. And probably we've identified that its accessibility could be improved. One of them is living in a supported residential service, which is about the rights and responsibilities, that tries to set out quite clearly, you know, issues around, you know, your rights as a resident. And we realise, you know, because the the profile of residents is changing, and SRS are being used a bit more for flow through, that we need to improve how we actually get that information to residents, not only just residents, but the services that are referring to them. We're always handing out information sheets to improve the information sharing so that when services refer residents, they are able to tell the resident what their rights and responsibilities are and what they're entitled to. And when they actually move into a supported residential service, the proprietor or the manager is supposed to actually sit down with them with an agreement and a support planning process to identify their needs and work with them. And we know that it is variable across the state. We have free training that if we discover that proprietors or their staff are more slack about that sort of thing, we will direct them to undertake training and try to improve their capability there. But you have identified an issue, because the population is changing in some parts of the metropolitan area.
Those booklets sound good, though, as a good start. So is there a place where they're available that people could get a hold of them? Advocates might want them too.
They are on our website, so they can be downloaded there. And there are two videos on our website that also are quite informative. And one of the videos involves residents themselves, trying to explain around living in an SRS and what is provided for them. Or you can contact us in the department about it, and we can send them out to people.
We're running out of time, so I'm really sorry that we haven't left enough for all of this information and digestion of it, but it's great that we can contact you, Margaret, at another time, and maybe advocates should take that invitation up.
Yes, we can leave our... we have an SRS email address that people can send their queries to.
That's great.
That's a good way of getting to them. Thank you very
Thank you,
much.
Margaret. And now I'd like to invite our final panellist, Rosemary Barker, who's the Manager of Volunteer Programs at the Office for the Public Advocate, and she manages the team of community visitors at OPA. Welcome, Rosemary.
Thanks. Thanks. Nice to be here. So OPA has 5 volunteer programs, and we've got over 900 volunteers. Community visitors is the largest program, and it's great to see some community visitors here and some past community visitors, so that's good to see. I don't know whether you all know what a community visitor does, but if you don't, I'll just give you a quick rundown. They're independent governor and council appointments for 3 years, and their real aim is to protect the human rights of people with a disability and or a mental illness. And we visit in three streams. So we visit in SRSs, we visit in disability shared supported accommodation, and we visit in mental health units. So we go across the state, and anybody here is interested in being a community visitor, see me afterwards. We always love to recruit new people. The program's been going for over 25 years. It was established in 87. And really what we see community visitors were about being the eyes and ears of the community and going into institutions and community-based residential facilities to have that oversight to see what's actually happening for people. Because a lot of these people don't have very many other people in their lives other than paid employees from either where they live or the services that they engage with. So community visitors are totally independent, and they come in and try and see what's actually happening for these people's lives. We've got quite an ability in terms of powers of entry, ability to see documentation. We generally visit in pairs, and we do it unannounced, so people don't know when we're going to come. And that means we get an opportunity to observe and report on what's actually happening. And community visitors do a report at every visit they make about what they've seen. And what they often will be doing is they'll be talking to residents, they'll be looking at documentation, they'll be watching the engagement between residents and staff and trying to see what's actually happening. And the one thing that we do each year, which is really our major piece of advocacy, is our annual report, and that's last year's annual report. It's tabled in Parliament, and the previous government determined that they would respond to the annual report in Parliament, and the new government has agreed that they'll continue to do that. So that's fantastic, because it actually highlights the recommendations that we're making to government and a response to them. And you will see, if you look back over annual reports, the last number of years that accommodation is one of the key issues that every community visitor raises constantly, because the realities are there isn't enough accommodation for people with a disability, it isn't always the right kind of accommodation, and it isn't always appropriate to their needs. So there's a range of issues that we've highlighted, and some of which have been touched on here today, and I just wanted to highlight some of the, I suppose, the key issues that we've been talking about. So that issue about insufficient housing. So the realities are there isn't enough accommodation for everybody who needs it. It's interesting, in the Barwon trial site and the NDIS, they've seen about 5,000 people come in the door that they didn't know existed prior to the NDIS starting. So these are people who are getting no services previously. They say in Barwon region there's no one on the DSR now because everybody's actually got a package. Whether or not their accommodation needs have been fully met is an entirely different question, because the issue was raised about the fact that the NDIS will not be providing accommodation for people, although they're interested in people looking at innovative models. And I've got to say that raises some concerns for us as well. We heard before about the fact that the Oakley Centre has got money in order to shut down its congregate care facility where they had 29 people living. And I can tell you, if you'd been to the Oakley Centre, to the congregate care facilities, you would have desperately wanted it to close, because there was nothing that could be done. They'd done everything they could to make that service better. But there was nothing more that could be done. And if you looked at what they'd had funding to build a couple of houses and the conditions that people were living in when they moved out into those houses in the community versus what they were living in the congregate care facility, you would know desperately that we had to close the Oakley Centre. And it's fantastic that that money's been found and that's happening, and I think that's terrific. What I am concerned about is that under the NDIS there's a whole range of people thinking that those kind of congregate care models is a great idea to be trying to re-engage with that. And not that long ago I saw an article in relation to Canberra where a number of families of people with a disability had clubbed together and they're building an accommodation facility for about 30 people with a disability. And whilst it sounds fantastic, and we've had a similar model here in Victoria with Singleton's Equity Housing, where people with a disability's families and the people with a disability bought into a facility, the problem that you have is unless it's done well, you end up with a very large facility with all those issues about congregate care, and you end up seeing a whole range of issues like we've seen with Singleton's Equity Housing about issues like the house might have been fine for the person when they moved in 20 years ago. 20 years later, they've aged substantially. They're now on a walker, in a wheelchair. They've got a whole range of needs. The house cannot meet those needs, and there is no money to be able to do anything about it. Now, the department obviously is taking these issues up and trying to do what they can about it, but that's one of the challenges that you have about some of those congregate care issues. The other issue is about refurbishment. In 2010-11, the strategic refurbishment program ended, and consequently there's been no large injection of funds to upgrade houses since then, and so it's been very piecemeal. And what that means is that a lot of houses' fabric is going through deterioration, and then there's no money to spend on bringing it up. It's also that issue about ageing in place. If people do want to age in place, you've got to probably change the nature of the facility to make sure that it actually meets their needs. But I suppose the biggest issue from our point of view, and from community visitors have documented this in annual reports and in the recent submissions that we've made to the Ombudsman's investigation to abuse reporting, to the Parliamentary Inquiry, to the Senate Inquiry, to the Royal Commission, you name it. We've talked about the issue about inappropriate placement of people, and there was quite a bit of discussion about, you know, who's put where. And I suppose one of the things that community visitors are constantly documenting is this issue of a house where there's, say, four older people, a vacancy comes up because someone, for example, dies, and they put a younger person in there, unfortunately often a young male with autism, who has a range of challenging behaviours, a range of issues, doesn't fit well into that environment, and then we have the issue about abuse, neglect, you know, the whole range of violence issues that can occur. And I just wanted to... One of the case studies that we put into the Ombudsman submission really highlighted this issue. And I just wanted to give you just a snapshot of this. And it was about our serious concerns about the impact of the behaviour of a 21-year-old resident with ID and a mental illness on the five older profoundly disabled residents and staff in that house. you know, they report escalating and increasing physical assaults and the impact of violence on the dignity and rights of lifestyle of the residents. So that's directly from community visitors documenting a range of case studies in the annual report. So that is one of the key issues that we see emerging in terms of that placement of people. And it is also challenging. We know that it's difficult because of the lack of stock to be able to put younger people together who will want to be more active, who will want to do a range of different things that the older people probably don't want to participate in. So that's one of the challenges in terms of having a limited amount of accommodation stock. The other issue that's been raised here is about respite, and community visitors over the last couple of years have been documenting this. In the last annual report, we talked about 34 people that we had documented who are living long-term in respite, including 12 children in one area. So it's people whose parents have got to the end of their tether, who have got insufficient supports, insufficient ability to manage the situation, and have been forced into the situation where they've had to leave their child in respite. And we've had people living, we've got people living up to 7 years in respite. And we think there's a range of challenges about that constant changing of people coming through there in their lives, whether or not the planning processes meet their needs. There's a whole range of issues that come into that. Obviously, in the SRS sector, we see that there's a range of challenges. Community visitors report on some fantastic SRSs, some reasonably good ones and some pretty mediocre or poor ones. But the thing that I have to say that we do feel quite concerned about is that over the last couple of years, we've seen the loss of 640 beds out of the SRS sector, and nowhere have they been compensated for. So when somebody says to me, the choice I have is to put a person into an SRS or to send them out the door into homelessness, I would much prefer that they're in an SRS. But when you see that massive loss of beds, you know that those options are reducing, and so it's very challenging in terms of managing that situation for people. One of the other issues that community visitors certainly have highlighted in their annual reports over recent years have been that transition. And I know the department tries to do the best they can, as do NGOs, but there are a lot of issues about transition. And quite often people get moved from one house to another and there's very little transition that happens. And we've seen recent examples of that where we've had notifications to the public advocate of assaults that have occurred because the transition wasn't managed effectively, and therefore a resident's paid the price of that. So that's one of the challenging issues that I think needs to be taken up. I just want to put a couple of other issues on the agenda for you to think about in relation to the NDIS. The issue that I raised about the new accommodation models, and I can tell you there's developers out there circling into the NDIS space thinking that there's great opportunities. And one of the issues that goes with that is a bit of a push that we've heard about people wanting to reduce the fire standards in supported accommodation in order to make the costs cheaper. So I just put that on the agenda for people to think about. And that other issue is obviously that issue about the congregate care model and how that might play. If there's new and innovative ways of doing it, great, we want to hear about it. That's why I highlighted the Winteringham one, which we think is fantastic and which has given older carers a lot of satisfaction that they can continue to have that daily engagement with their child, but they don't have to be solely responsible for them. Fantastic. But I want to see it done in a responsible way.
Can we have one question, Rob? Have we got time? Yes. Any questions for Rosemary? Yes, we've got one there.
And just, I've left copies of the last annual report on CD out on the table in case anybody wants to take away a copy.
Oh, on CD, great.
Hi, thank you. Judy Smith, advocate from Grampians Advocacy. Can you just explain to me where these beds have gone? Have I missed something in this story?
Sorry, where the beds... You're talking about... Well, I was talking about SRS beds.
Yes.
Well, the SRSs that have either transitioned into... Some of them transitioned to aged care. Some of them have closed. Some of them have changed what they're doing. I mean, one, we've been notified recently about one that's closed and the site's being redeveloped, so that SRS will be closing. So there's a whole range of outcomes. In some cases, the beds, I suppose, haven't been lost if you think they've gone to the aged care sector, but there certainly have been SRSs that have closed because people have determined that they want to either sell the business, do something different with their money, or in the case of the recent one, the site was so valuable, the person didn't actually own the site, and the site's being developed.
Can I just get you to answer one of my questions? Facilitator's privilege. As an advocate, I guess I'm just wondering what the relationship is. Can community visitors give out information about independent advocacy, or how do you, you know, kind of deal with an issue that you discover when you're just collecting information and observing?
Well, I suppose there's two things that I'd say. One is we advocate on an ongoing basis about this large range of issues. So we meet on a quarterly basis with the department in each of the three streams. We're constantly advocating. As you know, we advocate in our annual report. We talk to government about it whenever we can. But obviously, we're quite happy about engagement. People can contact our office, and certainly we can refer people to other agencies. We try and provide individual advocacy for people in the most extreme cases, but of course we've got limits in terms of our resources, but we're always happy to work with other organisations in a collaborative way as much as possible.
Collaboration.
Yeah. And the other thing I'd just say is we've just launched a new website, and on it it says if you want to request a community visitor, it tells you how to go about it. So if you feel like you need a community visitor to go out and have a look at an issue in a facility that you know about. The other thing is we have an advice service, and we take about 14,000 calls a year, and you can ring the advice service, and there's a 1300 number on our website. You can ring and ask for a community visitor to come out, particularly if you're aware of any issues of abuse or violence. We really would like you to contact us.
Thank you, Rosemary. Sorry you had to give that at record speed. But thanks to all our presenters today, Gulden Otar, Nicola Connolly, Angela Kopke, Andrew McCarty, Rosemary Barker and Margaret Summers. Thank you.
And thank you, Pauline Williams, for doing such a great job over the last two panels. You've put together a really good set of questions, and you've made our you've put our panelists through their paces. So thank you so much. Now we're just going to have a quick tea break, purely so that we can have a panelist changeover period. So get up, stretch your legs, make yourself a quick cuppa. And at 2:45, we'll reconvene for our next session. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.